feel well at all. Socrates was about to make some tea when I said, "Please, sit down, Soc. I'll make tea." He sat, nodding his head in approval. I leaned against the desk, feeling dizzy. My throat was sore. Perhaps the tea would help. As I filled the kettle and placed it on the hot plate, I asked, "Do I have to build some kind of road to this gate, then?" "Yes, in a sense, everyone must. You pave the way with your own work." Anticipating my next question, he said, "Anyone, any human being, male or female, young or old, has within the capacity to find the gate and pass through. But very few are moved to do so. Few are interested. This is very important. I didn't decide to teach you because of any inherent capacity you possessed. As a matter of fact, you have glaring weaknesses, along with your strong points. But you have the will to make this journey." That struck a resonant chord. "I guess you could compare it to gymnastics, Sock. Even someone who is overweight, weak, or inflexible can become a fine gymnast, but the preparation is longer, more difficult." "Yes, that's exactly what it's like. And I can tell you this, your path is going to be very steep." My head felt feverish, and I started to ache all over. I leaned against the desk again, and out of the corner of my eye saw Socrates come toward me, reaching out for my head. "Oh, no, not now, I'm not up to it," I thought, but he was only feeling my feverish forehead. Then he checked the glands in my neck, looked at my face and eyes, and felt my pulse for a long time. "Dan, your energies are way out of balance. Your spleen is probably swollen. I suggest you visit a physician, tonight, now." I was feeling really miserable by the time I limped to Cowell Hospital. My throat was burning, my body aching. The doctor confirmed Sock's diagnosis. My spleen was badly swollen. I had a severe case of mononucleosis and was admitted to the infirmary. During that first fitful, feverish night, I dreamed that I had one huge leg and one shriveled one. When I tried to swing on the bars or tumble, everything was crooked, and I fell into the late afternoon of the next day when Socrates walked in with a bouquet of dried flowers. "Socrates," I said weakly, delighted by his unexpected visit, "you shouldn't have." "Yes, I should have," he replied. "I'll have the nurse put them in a vase. I'll think of you when I look at them," I grinned weakly. "They're not to look at, they're to eat," he said, leaving the room. A few minutes later he returned with a glass of hot water. Crushing some of the flowers, he wrapped them in a piece of cheesecloth he'd brought and dipped the tea bag into the water. "This tea will strengthen you and help cleanse the blood. Here, drink." It tasted bitter. Strong medicine. Then he took a small bottle of yellow liquid in which were floating more crushed herbs and massaged the liquid deep into my right leg directly over the scar. I wondered what the nurse, a very pretty, businesslike young woman, would say if she came in. "What is that yellow stuff in the bottle, Sock?" "Oh, urine, with a few herbs." "Urine," I said, pulling my leg away from him with disgust. "Don't be silly," he said, grabbing my leg and pulling it back. "Urine is a very respected elixir in the ancient healing traditions." I closed my tired, aching eyes. My head was throbbing like jungle drums. I felt the fever starting to rise again. Socrates put his hand against my head, then felt the pulse in my wrist. "Good, the herbs are taking effect. Tonight should be the crisis. Tomorrow you'll feel better." I managed a barely audible, "Thank you, Doc Sock." He reached over and put his hand on my solar plexus. Almost immediately, everything in my body intensified. I thought my head would explode. The fever started to burn me up. My glands pulsated. Worst of all was a terrible burning pain in my right leg at the site of the injury. "Stop it, Socrates, stop it," I yelled. He took his hand away, and I collapsed onto the bed. "I've just introduced a little more energy into your body than you're used to," he explained. "It will accelerate the healing processes. It burns only where you have knots. If you were free of obstructions, if your mind was clear, your heart open, and your body free of tension, you'd experience the energy as an indescribable pleasure, better than sex. You'd think you were in heaven, and in a way, you'd be right."
"Sometimes you scare me, Socrates."
The nurse walked in.
"Time to take your temperature, Mr. Milman."
Socrates had risen politely when she entered. I lay in bed looking pale and miserable. The contrast between the two of us had never felt greater than at this moment. The nurse smiled at Socrates, who grinned back. I think your son is going to be just fine with a little rest, she said.
Just what I keep telling him, Sock said.
She smiled at him again. Was that a flirtatious look she gave him? With a rustle of white, she walked out of the room, looking blatantly appealing.
Socrates sighed. Ah, there's something about a woman in uniform.
Then he put his hand on my forehead. I fell into a deep sleep. The next morning I felt like a new man. The doctor's eyebrows rose as he checked my spleen, felt for my swollen glands, and rechecked my chart. He was dumbfounded.
I can't find anything wrong with you, Mr. Millman.
He sounded almost apologetic.
You can go home after lunch.
Get plenty of rest.
He walked out, staring at my chart.
The nurse rustled by again.
Help, I yelled.
Yes, she said, stepping inside.
I can't understand it, nurse. I think I'm having heart trouble. Every time you go by, my pulse gets erratic.
Don't you mean erratic, she said.
Oh, whatever.
Smiling at me, she said, it sounds like you're ready to go home.
That's what everyone keeps telling me, but you're all mistaken. I'm sure I'll need private nursing care.
Smiling invitingly, she turned and walked away.
Nurse, don't leave me, I cried.
That afternoon, walking home, I was astonished by the improvement in my leg. I still limped badly, throwing my hip out to the side whenever I took a step, but I could almost walk without my cane. Maybe there was something to Sock's magic urine treatment or the battery charge he had given me. School had begun, and I was again surrounded by other students and books and assignments, but that was all secondary to me now. I could play the game without concern. I had much more important things to do in a small gas station west of campus. After a long nap, I walked to the station. The moment I sat down, Sock said, "Lots of work to do."
"Oh, what is that?" I said, stretching and yawning.
"A complete overhaul."
"Oh, a big job."
"Especially big. We're going to overhaul you."
"Oh, yeah," I said. "Oh, hell," I thought.
"Like the phoenix, you're going to throw yourself into the fire and rise from your ashes."
"I'm ready," I said. "For my New Year's resolution, I'm going to give up donuts."
Socrates grinned at me, saying, "I wish it were that simple. Right now, you're a tangled mass of twisted circuits and outmoded habits. You're going to have to change habits of acting, of thinking, of dreaming, and of seeing the world. Most of what you are is a series of bad habits." He was starting to get to me.
"Damn it, Socrates. I've overcome some difficult hurdles, and I'm still doing the best I can. Can't you show me some respect?"
Socrates threw back his head and laughed. Then he walked over to me and pulled my shirt out. As I was tucking it back in, he mussed up my hair. "Listen to me, oh great buffoon. Everyone wants respect. But it is not just a matter of saying, 'Please respect me.' You must earn respect by acting respectable. And the respect of a warrior is not easily earned." I counted to 10, then asked, "How then am I going to earn your respect?"
"By changing your act."
"What act is that?"
"Your poor me act, of course.
Stop being so proud of mediocrity. Show some spirit." Grinning as usual, Socrates jumped up and slapped me playfully on my cheek. Then he poked me in the ribs.
"Stop it," I yelled, in no mood for his play.
I reached out to grab his arm, but he leaped lightly up on the desk. Then he leaped over my head, spun, and pushed me backwards onto the couch. Climbing angrily to my feet, I tried to push him back, but just as I touched him, he leaped backward over the desk. I fell forwards onto the carpet.
"God damn it," I raged, seeing red.
He slipped out the door into the garage. I limped after him in pursuit. Socrates perched on a fender and scratched his head.
"Why, Dan, you're angry."
"Stunning observation," I fumed, panting heavily.
"Good," he said. "Considering your predicament, you should be angry. But make sure you direct that anger wisely."
Sock deftly began to change the spark plugs on a VW. "Anger is one of your main tools to transform old habits." He removed an old plug with the spark plug wrench and replaced them with new ones. He threaded a new plug into the block, tightening it with a firm tug of the wrench.
"Anger can burn away old habits. Fear and sorrow inhibit action, you see. Anger generates it. When you learn to make proper use of your anger, you can transmute fear and sorrow to anger, and anger to action. That's your body's secret of internal alchemy." Back in the office, Socrates drew some water from the spring water dispenser and put on the evening's tea specialty, rose hips, as he continued. "You have many habits that weaken you. The secret of change is to focus all your energy not on fighting the old, but on building the new." How can I control my habits if I can't even control my emotions, Sock?
He sat back in his chair. It is like this. When your mind creates a problem, when it resists life as it unfolds in the moment, your body tenses and feels this tension as an emotion, variously interpreted by words like fear, sorrow, or anger. True emotion, Dan, is pure energy flowing freely in the body. Sometimes it's appropriate to express fear, sorrow, or anger, but the energy should be directed completely outward, not held in. The expression of emotions should be complete and powerful, then should vanish without a trace. The way to control your emotions, then, is to let them flow, then let them go. I got up, took the whistling kettle off the hot plate, and poured our steaming tea.
Can you give me a specific example, Socrates?
All right, then, he said. Spend time with a baby. Smiling, I blew on my tea. Funny, I never thought of babies as masters of emotional control.
When a baby is upset, he said, it expresses itself in banshee wails, pure crying. It doesn't wonder about whether it should be crying.
Hold or feed that baby, and within seconds, no more tears. If the baby is angry, then it very definitely lets you know. But this, too, it lets go of very quickly.
Can you imagine a baby's feeling guilty about its anger?
Babies let it flow, then let it go. They express themselves fully, then shut up. Infants are fine teachers, and they demonstrate the right use of energy. Learn that, and you can transform any habit.
A Ford Ranchero wagon pulled into the station. Socrates went around to the driver's seat, while I, chuckling, grabbed the gas hose and removed the gas cap. Inspired by his enlightening revelation of how to control emotions, I yelled over the roof of the car, "Just tell me what to do, and set me loose, Sock. I'll tear those nasty habits to shreds."
Then I got a look at the passengers, 3 shocked nuns. I choked on my words and, turning beet red, busied myself with washing the windows. Socrates just leaned against the pump and buried his face in his hands. After the ranchero pulled out, much to my relief, another customer drove in. It was the blonde man again, the one with the curly beard. He jumped out of the car and gave Socrates a bear hug.
"Good to see you as always, Joseph," Socrates said.
"Same here. Socrates, isn't it?"
He gave me a beguiling grin.
"Joseph, this young question machine is named Dan. Push a button and he asks a question. Marvelous to have around, really, when I've no one to talk to."
Joseph shook my hand. "Has the old man mellowed in his declining years?" he asked with a broad smile. Before I could assure him that Sock was probably more ornery than ever, the old man interrupted.
"Oh, I've really become lazy. Dan has it much easier than you did."
"Oh, I see," Joseph said, maintaining a serious countenance. "You haven't taken him on any 100-mile runs or worked with the burning coals yet, hm?"
"No, nothing like that. We're just about to start with the basics, like how to eat, walk, and breathe."
Joseph laughed merrily. I found myself laughing with him.
"Speaking of eating," he said, "why don't both of you come to my cafe this morning? You'll be my private guests, and I'll whip up something for breakfast."
I was just about to say, "Oh, I'd like to, but I really can't," when Socrates volunteered, "We'd be delighted. The morning shift gets on in half an hour. We'll walk over."
"Great. See you then."
He handed Sock a $5 bill for the gas and drove off.
I wondered about Joseph. "Is he a warrior like you, Sock?"
"No one is a warrior like me," he answered, laughing. "Nor would anyone want to be. Every man or woman has natural qualities. For example, while you've excelled in gymnastics, Joseph has mastered the preparation of food."
"Oh, you mean cooking?"
"Not exactly. Joseph doesn't heat food much. He prepares natural foods in a way you'll see for yourself. After a taste of Joseph's culinary magic, he'll have no tolerance for fast food joints ever again."
"And what's so special about his cooking?"
"Only 2 things, really, both subtle. First, he gives his complete attention to what he does. Second, love is literally one of the primary ingredients in everything he makes. You can taste it afterwards for a long time."
Sock's replacement, a lanky teenager, came in with his usual grunted greeting. We left, crossed the streets, and headed south. My limping pace quickened to keep up with Sock's strides as we took the scenic route down side streets, avoiding early morning rush hour traffic. While we walked, we talked. Socrates began, "Dan, a tremendous amount of energy is necessary to cut through the mists of your mind and find the gate. We're going to clean you out, take you apart, and put you back together again. You're going to readapt your every human function, moving, sleeping, breathing, thinking, feeling, and eating. Of all the human activities, eating is one of the most important to stabilize first.
Wait a minute, Socrates. Eating isn't really a problem area for me. I'm slim. I generally feel pretty good, and my gymnastics proves I have enough energy. How is changing a few things in my diet going to make a difference?
Your present diet, he said, glancing up through the sunlit branches of a beautiful tree, may give you a normal amount of energy. But much of what you eat also makes you groggy, affects your moods, lowers your level of awareness, and interferes with your body's optimal vitality. Your impulsive diet results in toxic residues that have a long-range effect on your longevity. Most of your mental and emotional problems could be minimized by simple attention to proper eating.
How can changing my diet affect my energy, I argued. I mean, I take in calories, and they represent a certain amount of energy.
That is the traditional view, but it is a shallow one. The warrior must recognize more subtle influences. Our primary source of energy in this system, he said, waving his arm to indicate the solar system, is the sun. A proper diet allows you to make the most direct use of the sun's energy. The ensuing store of energy will open your senses, expand your awareness, and sharpen your concentration into a slashing blade.
All that is going to happen by eliminating cupcakes from my diet?
Yes, by eliminating cupcakes and a few other odds and ends.
Well, one of the Japanese Olympic gymnasts once told me that it's not your bad habits that count, but your good ones.
That means your good habits must become so strong that they dissolve those which are not useful.
Socrates pointed ahead to a small cafe on Shattuck, near Ashby.
I'd walk there many times without really noticing it.
So you believe in natural foods, Soc? I said as we crossed the street.
It's not a matter of believing, but of doing. I can tell you this. I eat only what is wholesome, and I eat only as much as I need. In order to appreciate what you call natural foods, you have to sharpen your instincts. You have to become a natural man.
Sounds positively ascetic to me. Don't you ever have a little ice cream now and then?
My diet, he said, may at first seem Spartan compared to the indulgences you call moderation. But the way I eat is actually filled with pleasure, because I've developed the capacity to enjoy the simplest foods, and so will you.
We knocked on the door, and Joseph opened it.
Come in, come in, he said enthusiastically, as if welcoming us to his home. It did, in fact, look like a home. Morning light poured through a skylight overhead. We sat directly below it, in the warm rays of the sun, occasionally shaded by clouds drifting overhead. Joseph approached us, carrying two plates over his head. With a flourish, he placed them in front of us, serving Socrates first, then me.
Ah, it looks delicious, said Socrates, tucking his napkin around the neck of his shirt.
I looked down. There before me, on a white plate, were a sliced carrot and a piece of lettuce. I stared at it in consternation. At my expression, Socrates almost fell out of his chair laughing, and Joseph had to lean against a table.
Ah, I said with a sigh of relief, it is a joke then.
Without another word, Joseph took the plates and returned with two beautiful wooden bowls. In each bowl was a perfectly carved miniature replica of a mountain. The mountain itself was a blended combination of cantaloupe and honeydew melon. Small chunks of walnuts and almonds, individually carved, became brown boulders. The craggy cliffs were made from apples and thin slices of cheese. The trees were made of many pieces of parsley, each pruned to a perfect shape, like bonsai trees. An icing of yogurt capped the peak. Around the base were halved grapes and a ring of fresh strawberries. I sat and stared.
Joseph, it's too beautiful. I can't eat this. I want to take a picture of it.
Socrates, I noticed, had already begun eating, nibbling slowly, as was his manner. I attacked the mountain with gusto and was soon done. When Socrates suddenly started gobbling up his food, I realized he was mimicking me. I did my best to take small bites, breathing deeply between each bite as he did, but it seemed frustratingly slow.
The pleasure you get from eating, Dan, is limited to the taste of the food and the feeling of a full belly. You must learn to enjoy the entire process, the hunger beforehand, the careful preparation, setting an attractive table, chewing, breathing, smelling, tasting, swallowing, and the feeling of lightness and energy after the meal. Finally, you can enjoy the full and easy elimination of the food after it's digested.
When you pay attention to all these elements, you'll begin to appreciate simple meals. You won't need as much food. The irony of your present eating habits is that while you fear missing a meal, you aren't fully aware of the meals you do eat.
I'm not afraid of missing a meal, I argued.
I'm glad to hear that, he said. It will make the coming week easier for you. This meal is the last one you'll be having for the next 7 days. Sok then proceeded to outline a purifying fast that I was to begin immediately. Diluted fruit juice or plain herb teas were to be my only fare.
But Socrates, I need my protein and iron to help my leg heal. I need my energy for gymnastics.
It was no use. Socrates could be a very unreasonable man. We helped Joseph with a few chores, talked for a while, thanked him, and left. I was already hungry. While we walked back toward campus, Socrates summarized the disciplines I was to follow until my body regained its natural instincts. In a few years, there will be no need for rules. For now, however, you're to eliminate all food that contains refined sugar, refined flour, meat, and eggs, as well as drugs including coffee, alcohol, tobacco, or any other non-useful food. Eat only fresh, unrefined, unprocessed foods. In general, make breakfast a fresh fruit meal, maybe with a little cottage cheese or yogurt. Your lunch, your main meal, should be a raw salad, baked or steamed potato, and whole grain bread or cooked grains. Dinner should be a raw salad, and on occasion, lightly steamed vegetables. Make good use of raw, unsalted seeds and nuts. I guess by now you're quite an expert on nuts, Sok, I grumbled. On the way home, we passed by a neighborhood grocery store. I was about to go inside and get some cookies when I remembered that I was no longer allowed to eat store-bought cookies for the rest of my life, and for the next 6 days and 23 hours, I wouldn't be eating anything at all.
Socrates, I'm hungry.
I never said that the training of a warrior would be a piece of cake, he replied. We walked through campus just between classes, so Sproul Plaza was filled with people. I gazed wistfully at the pretty co-eds. Socrates touched my arm.
That reminds me, Dan. Culinary sweets aren't the only indulgence you're going to have to avoid for a while.
Uh-oh, I stopped dead in my tracks. I want to make very sure I don't misunderstand you. Can you be more specific, Sok?
Sure I can, he replied.
While you may of course enjoy intimate, heartfelt relationships, until you are sufficiently mature, you are to refrain completely from your preoccupation with sexual release. Dispel it out for you. Keep it in your pants.
But Sok, I argued, as if on trial for my life, that's old-fashioned, puritanical, unreasonable, and unhealthy.
Cutting down on food is one thing, but this is different. I started quoting the Playboy philosophy, Albert Ellis, Robert Rimmer, Jacqueline Suzanne, and the Marquis de Sade. I even threw in Reader's Digest and Dear Abby, but nothing moved him. He said, there's no point in my trying to explain my reasons. You're just going to have to find your future thrills in fresh air, fresh foods, fresh water, fresh awareness, and sunshine.
How can I possibly follow every discipline you demand?
Consider the final words of advice that Buddha gave to his disciples. What did he say? I waited inspiration. Do your best. With that, Sok vanished into the crowd. The next week, my rites of initiation got underway. While my stomach growled, Sok filled my nights with basic exercises, teaching me how to breathe more deeply and slowly, mouth lightly closed and the tongue on the roof of the mouth. I plodded on, doing my best, feeling lethargic, looking forward to my, diluted fruit juice and herb tea, dreaming about steaks and sweet rolls, and I didn't even particularly like steaks or sweet rolls. He told me to breathe with my belly one day and to breathe with my heart the next. He began to criticize my walking, my talking, the way my eyes wandered around the room as my mind wandered around the universe. Nothing I did seemed to satisfy him. Over and over he corrected me, sometimes gently, sometimes harshly.
Proper posture is a way of blending with gravity, Dan. Proper attitude is a way of blending with life.
And so it went. The third day of the fast was the hardest. I was weak and cranky. I had headaches and bad breath.
All part of the purification process, Dan. Your body is cleaning out, getting rid of stored toxins.
At workout, all I did was lie around and stretch. I was actually feeling good, even cocky, the seventh day of the fast. I felt I could go longer. My hunger had disappeared long before. All I felt in its stead was a pleasant lassitude and feeling of lightness. Workouts actually improved. Limited only by my weak leg, I trained hard, feeling relaxed and more supple than ever. When I started eating on the eighth day, beginning with very small amounts of fruit, I had to use all my willpower not to start gorging myself on whatever I was allowed to eat. Socrates tolerated no complaints, no backtalk. In fact, he didn't want me to talk at all unless it was absolutely necessary. "No more idle jabbering," he said. "What comes out of your mouth is as important as what goes into it." I was thus able to censor the inane comments that used to make me appear a fool. It actually felt pretty good to talk less once I started getting the knack of it. I felt calmer somehow. But after a few weeks, I tired of it. My main problem was fitting in socially with my friends. Rick, Sid, and I took dates to Laval's for pizza. Everyone else, including my date, shared an extra-large sausage pizza. I ordered a small, whole-wheat, vegetarian special. They had milkshakes or beer. I sipped my apple juice. They wanted to go to Fenton's ice cream parlor afterward. While they ate their sundaes, I sucked on a piece of ice. I looked at them enviously. They looked back with vague resentment. I probably made them feel guilty. My social life was collapsing under the weight of my disciplines. I would walk blocks out of my way to avoid the donut shops, food stands, and outdoor restaurants near campus. My cravings and compulsions were becoming obvious to me, but I fought back. If I turned into a jellyfish over a jelly donut, I just wouldn't be able to face Socrates. As time passed, though, I began to feel a growing resistance. I complained to Socrates, in spite of his dark look. "Sock, you're no fun anymore. You've become an ordinary grumpy old man. You never even glow." He glowered at me. "No more magic tricks." That was just it. No tricks, no sex, no potato chips, no hamburgers, no candy, no donuts, no fun, and no rest. Discipline in the station and out. January had trudged by. February had flown, and now March was nearly over. The team was finishing the season without me. Again I told Socrates my feelings, but he offered no consolation, no support. "Socrates, I'm a real spiritual Boy Scout. My friends don't want to go out with me anymore. You're ruining my life. I'm afraid I'll become a dried-up old..." Socrates interrupted me. "Dan, if dehydration is what you fear, I can assure you that my late wife considered me rather juicy." "Your wife?" He laughed again at my shocked expression. Then he looked at me. I thought he wanted to say something else, but he only resumed his paperwork and said, "Do your best." "Well, thank you for the stirring pep talk." Deep down, I was offended by having another person, even Socrates, direct my life. Still, I fulfilled every rule with teeth-clenching determination, until one day during workout, in walked the dazzling nurse who had starred in my erotic fantasies since my stay in the hospital. She sat down quietly and watched our aerial routines. Almost immediately, I noticed, everyone in the gym was inspired to a new level of energy. Pretending to be immersed in practice, I glanced at her every now and then out of the corner of my eyes. Her tight silk pants and halter top had snared my concentration. My mind kept drifting off to more exotic forms of gymnastics. For the rest of workout, I was acutely conscious of her attention. She disappeared just before the end of training. I showered, dressed, and headed up the stairs, and there she was, at the top of the staircase, leaning seductively against the banister. I don't even remember walking up the final flight of stairs. "Hi, Dan Millman. I'm Valerie. You look much better than when I cared for you in the hospital." "I am better, Nurse Valerie," I grinned, "and I'm so glad you cared." She laughed and stretched invitingly. "Dan, I wonder if you'd do me a big favor. Would you walk me home? It's getting dark out, and a strange man has been following me." I was about to point out that it was early April and the sun wouldn't be going down for another hour, but then thought, what the hell, a petty detail. We walked, we talked, and I ended up having dinner at her apartment. She opened her bottle of special wine for special occasions. I merely had a sip, but it was the beginning of the end. I was sizzling, hotter than the steak on the grill. There was a moment when a little voice asked, "Are you a man or a jellyfish?" Another little voice answered, "I'm one horny jellyfish." That night, I washed out on every discipline I'd been given. I ate whatever she gave me. I started with a cup of clam chowder, then salad and steak, and for dessert, I had several helpings of Valerie. For the next 3 days, I couldn't sleep very well, preoccupied with how to present my true confession to Socrates. I was prepared for the worst. That night, I walked into the office and told him everything, without apology, and waited, holding my breath. Socrates didn't speak for a long time. Finally, he said, "I noticed you haven't learned to breathe yet." Before I could reply, he held up his hand. "Dan, I can understand how you might choose an ice cream cone or a fling with a pretty woman over the way I have shown you. But can you understand it?" He paused. "No praise, no blame. You now understand the compelling hungers in your belly and your loins." Socrates turned his eyes on bright. They shone through me. "Come back in a month, but only if you've strictly applied the disciplines. See you next month." I knew that if I forgot the disciplines again, it would be the end for me and Socrates. With a growing inner resolve, I said, "I'll master my impulses or die." Valerie called me the next day. I felt all the familiar stirrings at the sound of her voice, which had moaned in my ear not long before. "Danny, I'd love to see you tonight. Are you available?" "Oh, good. I get off work at 7. Shall I meet you at the gym?" "Okay, see you then. Bye." I took her to Joseph's cafe that night for a supreme salad surprise. I noticed that Valerie was flirting with Joseph. He was his usual warm self, but showed no sign of returning her flirtations. Later, we returned to her apartment. We sat and talked a while. She offered wine. I asked for juice. She touched my hair and kissed me softly, murmuring in my ear. I kissed her back with feeling. Then my inner voice came through loud and clear. "Get yourself together. Remember what you must." I sat up, taking a deep breath. This wasn't going to be easy. She sat up too, straightening herself, patting her hair. "Valerie, you know I find you very attractive and exciting, but I'm involved in some, personal disciplines that no longer allow for what was about to happen. I enjoy your company and want to see you again, but from now on I suggest you think of me as an intimate friend, a loving priest. I almost couldn't get it out. She took a deep breath and smoothed her hair again. "Dan, it's really good to be with someone who isn't interested only in sex." "Well," I said, encouraged, "I'm glad to hear you feel that way, because I know we can share many things besides a bed." She looked at her watch. "Oh, will you look at the time? And I have to work early tomorrow, too, so I'll say good night, Dan. Thank you for the dinner. It was lovely." I called her the next day, but her phone was busy. I called the following day and finally reached her. "I'm going to be very busy with nursing exams for the next few weeks," she said. I saw her 1 week later when she appeared at the end of practice to meet Scott, one of the other guys on the team. They both walked right past me as I came up the stairs, so close that I could smell her perfume. She nodded politely and said hello. Scott leered back at me and gave me a meaningful wink. I didn't know a wink could hurt so much. With a desperate hunger that a raw salad repast couldn't possibly satisfy, I found myself in front of the charbroiler. I smelled the sizzling hamburgers, basted with special sauce. I remembered all the good times I'd had eating burgers with lettuce and tomatoes and friends. In a daze, I went in without thinking, walked right up to the woman behind the counter and heard myself say, "One charbroiled with double cheese, please." She gave it to me and I sat down, held it to my mouth, and took a huge bite. Suddenly, I realized what I was doing, choosing between Socrates and a cheeseburger. I spit it out, threw it angrily in the trash, and walked out. It was over. I was through being a slave to random impulses. That night marked the beginning of a new glow of self-respect and a feeling of personal power. I knew it would get easier now. Small changes began to add up in my life. Ever since I was a kid, I'd suffered through all kinds of minor symptoms like a runny nose at night when the air cooled, headaches, stomach upsets, and mood swings, all of which I thought were normal and inevitable. Now they'd all vanished. I felt a constant sense of lightness and energy which radiated around me. Maybe that accounted for the number of women flirting with me, the little kids and dogs coming up to me and wanting to play. A few of my teammates started asking for advice about personal problems. No longer a small boat in a stormy sea, I started to feel more like the Rock of Gibraltar. I told Socrates about my experience. He nodded. "Your energy level is rising. Then he added, "On the other hand, it would be premature for self-congratulation. To keep your perspective, you'd better compare yourself to me. Then it will be clear that you've only graduated from kindergarten." School ended for the year almost without my noticing it. Exams went smoothly. The studies that had always seemed to be a major struggle for me had become a minor piece of business to get out of the way. The team left for a short vacation, then returned for summer workouts. I was beginning to walk without my cane and even tried to run very slowly a few times a week. I continued pushing myself to the limit of pain, discipline, and endurance, and of course, I continued to do my best with right eating, right moving, and right breathing. But my best was still not very good. Socrates started to increase his demands on me. "Now that your energy is building, you can begin training in earnest," he said. I practiced breathing so slowly that it took 1 minute to complete each breath. When combined with intense concentration and control of specific muscle groups, this breathing exercise heated my body up like a sauna and allowed me to remain comfortable outside, no matter what the temperature. I was excited to realize that I was developing the same power that Sok had shown me on the night we met. For the first time, I began to believe that maybe, just maybe, I could become a warrior of his stature. No longer feeling left out, I now felt superior to my friends. When a friend complained of illness or other problems that I knew could be remedied by simply eating properly, I told him what I'd learned about responsibility and discipline. I took my newfound confidence with me to the station one night, feeling sure that I was about to learn some ancient and arcane secrets of India, Tibet, or China. Instead, as soon as I stepped through the door, I was handed a mop and told to clean the bathroom. "Make those toilets shine." For weeks afterward, I did so many menial tasks around the station that I had no time for my important exercises. I lifted tires for 1 hour, then took out the trash. I swept the garage and straightened the tools. I had never imagined it could happen, but being around Socrates was getting boring. At the same time, it was impossibly demanding. He'd give me 5 minutes to do a half-hour job, then criticize me mercilessly if it wasn't done thoroughly. He was unfair, unreasonable, and even insulting. As I was considering my disgust with the state of affairs, Socrates stepped into the garage to tell me that I'd left dirt on the bathroom floor. "But someone used the bathroom after I finished," I said. "No excuses," he said, and added, "throw out the garbage." I was so mad that I gripped my broom handle like a sword. I felt an icy calm. "But I just threw the garbage out 5 minutes ago, Socrates. Do you remember, old man, or are you getting senile?" He grinned. "I'm talking about this garbage, baboon." He tapped his head and winked at me. The broom clattered to the floor. Another evening, when I was sweeping the garage, Socrates called me into his office. I sat down, sullen, waiting for more orders. "Dan, you still haven't learned to breathe naturally. You've been indolent and need to concentrate more." That was the last straw. I screamed at him. "You've been the indolent one. I've been doing all the work for you." He paused, and I actually thought I saw pain in his eyes. Softly, he said, "It isn't proper, Dan, to yell at your teacher." Again, I remembered that the purpose of his insults had always been to show me my own mental and emotional turbulence, to turn my anger to action, and to help me persevere. Before I could apologize, he said, "Dan, you'd better go away and not come back until you have learned courtesy, and until you can breathe properly." Sadly, I shuffled out, my head down. As I walked home, I considered how patient he had been with my tantrums, complaints, and questions. All of his demands had been to serve me. I vowed never to yell at him in anger again. Alone, I tried harder than ever to correct my tense habits of breathing, but it only seemed to get worse. If I breathed deeply, I'd forget to keep my tongue on the roof of my mouth. If I remembered that, I'd slouch over. I was going crazy. In frustration, I went back to the station to see Sok and ask for his advice. I found him tinkering in the garage. He took one look at me and said, "Go away." Angry and hurt, I wordlessly limped off into the night. I heard his voice behind me. "After you learn how to breathe, do something about your sense of humor." His laughter seemed to chase me halfway home. It was almost midsummer when I remembered Joseph's Cafe. I'd been so busy with training in the day and with Sok at night that I hadn't made time to visit him. Now I thought, sadly, my nights were completely free. I walked to Joseph's Cafe just at closing time. The place was empty.
I found Joseph in the kitchen, lovingly cleaning the fine porcelain dishes. We were so different, Joseph and I. I was short, muscular, athletic, with short hair and a clean-shaven face. Joseph was tall, lean, even fragile-looking, with a soft, curly, blonde beard. I moved and talked quickly. He did everything with slow-motion care. In spite of our differences, or maybe because of them, I was drawn to him. We talked into the night as I helped him stack chairs and sweep the floors. Even as I talked, I concentrated as well as I could on my breathing, which made me drop a dish and trip over the carpet. "Joseph," I asked, "did Socrates really make you go on 100-mile runs?" "No, Dan," he laughed. "My temperament isn't really suited for athletic feats. Didn't Soc tell you? I was his cook and personal attendant for years." "No, he never told me. But what do you mean that you were his attendant for years? You couldn't be older than 28 or 29. Joseph beamed. "I'm a bit older than that. I'm 52. "Are you serious?" He nodded. There certainly was something to these disciplines. "But if you didn't do very much physical training, what did you do? What was your training?" Dan, I was a very angry and self-centered young man. By making extremely rigorous demands on me for service, he showed me how to give myself away, with real happiness and love. "And what a better place to learn how to serve," I said, "than at a service station?" Smiling, Joseph said, "He wasn't always a service station attendant, you know. His life has been extremely unusual and varied." "Tell me about it," I urged. "Hasn't Socrates told you about his past?" "No, he likes to keep it mysterious. I don't even know where he lives." "Not surprising. Well, I'd better keep it mysterious, too, until he wants you to know." "You said he made rigorous demands on you." "Yes, very rigorous. Nothing I did was good enough. And if I had a single negative thought, he always seemed to know and would send me off for weeks. As a matter of fact, I may not ever be able to see him again." "Oh, why so?" "He said I had to stay away until I could breathe properly, relaxed and natural. I've been trying, but I just can't." "Ah, that," he said, putting down the broom. He came over to me and put his hand on my belly and one on my chest. "Now breathe," he said. I started breathing deeply the way Socrates had shown me. "No, don't try so hard," said Joseph. After a few minutes, I started to feel funny in my belly and chest. In that moment, I was breathing completely without effort. It felt like I was being breathed. It felt so pleasurable, I could hardly contain myself. But then I felt the breathing start to tighten again. "Joseph, I lost it." "Don't worry, Dan. You just need to relax a little. I helped you with that. Now you know what natural breathing feels like. To stabilize it, you'll have to let yourself breathe naturally, more and more, until it starts to feel normal." "Joseph," I said, hugging him, "I don't know how you did what you did, but thank you. Thank you so much." He flashed that smile that made me feel warm all over and, putting the broom away, said, "Give my regards to Socrates." My breathing didn't improve right away. I still struggled. But one afternoon, after an early workout in the gym, pressing weights with my improving leg, I was walking home and noticed that without trying, my breathing was completely natural, close to the way I felt at the cafe. That night, I burst into the office, ready to regale Socrates with my success and apologize for my behavior. He looked like he'd been expecting me. As I skidded to a halt in front of him, he said calmly, "Okay, let's continue," as if I'd just returned from the bathroom rather than 6 weeks of intensive training. "Have you nothing else to say, Sock? No, well done, lad? No, looking good?" "Praise and blame are forms of manipulation that you no longer require." I shook my head in exasperation, but at least I was back. When I wasn't cleaning toilets, I was learning new and more frustrating exercises, like meditating on internal sounds until I could hear several at once. One night, as I practiced that exercise, I found myself drawn into a state of peace and relaxation I had never known before. For a period of time, I don't know for how long, I felt as if I were out of my body. This was the first time that my own efforts and energy resulted in a paranormal experience. I hadn't needed Sock's fingers pressing into my head. Excited, I told him about it. Instead of congratulating me, he said, "Dan, don't get distracted by your experiences. Cut through the visions and sounds and see the lessons behind them. They are signs of transformation, but if you don't go beyond them, you never go anywhere. If you want an experience, go see a movie. It's easier than yoga. Meditate all day if you like.
hear sounds and see lights, or even see sounds and hear lights. You'll still remain a jackass if you become trapped by experience. Let it go. I've suggested that you become a vegetarian, not a vegetable. Frustrated, I said, I'm only experiencing, as you call it, because you told me to. Socrates looked at me as if surprised. Do I have to tell you everything? About to get furious, I found myself laughing. He laughed too, pointing at me. Dan, you just transmuted anger to laughter. This means your energy level is much higher than before. Barriers are breaking down. Maybe you're making a little progress, after all. We were still chuckling when he handed me the mop. The following night, for the first time, Socrates was completely silent about my behavior. I got the message. I was going to have to be responsible for watching myself from now on. That's when I realized the kindness in all of his criticisms. I almost missed them. I wasn't aware of it then, nor would I realize it until months later, but that evening Socrates had stopped being my parent and started being my friend. I decided to pay Joseph a visit and tell him what had happened. As I walked down Shattuck, a couple of fire engines wailed by me. I didn't think anything about it until I neared the cafe and saw the orange sky. I began to run. The crowd was already dispersing when I arrived. Joseph had just arrived himself and was standing in front of his charred and gutted cafe. I was still 20 yards away from Joseph when I heard his cry of anguish and saw him drop slowly to his knees and cry. He leaped up with a scream of fury. Then he relaxed. He saw me. Dan, it's good to see you again. His face was serene. The fire chief came over to him and told him that the fire had probably started in the dry cleaners next door. Thank you, Joseph said. Oh, Joseph, I'm so sorry. Then my curiosity surfaced. Joseph, I saw you a minute ago. You were very upset. He smiled. Yes, I felt very upset, so I really let it out. I remembered Sock's words, let it flow and let it go. Until now it had just been a nice idea, but here, before the blackened, waterlogged remains of his beautiful cafe, this fragile warrior had actually demonstrated complete mastery of his emotions. Oh, it was such a beautiful place, Joseph, I sighed, shaking my head. Yes, he said wistfully, wasn't it? For some reason his calm now bothered me. Aren't you upset now at all? He looked at me dispassionately, then said, I have a story you might enjoy, Dan. Want to hear it? Well, okay. In a small fishing village in Japan, there lived a young, unmarried woman who gave birth to a child. Her parents felt disgraced and demanded to know the identity of the father. Afraid, she refused to tell them. The fisherman she loved had told her secretly that he was going off to seek his fortune and would return to marry her. Her parents persisted. In desperation, she named Hakuin, a monk who lived in the hills, as the father. Outraged, the parents took the infant girl up to his door, pounded until he opened it, and handed him the baby, saying, This child is yours. You must care for it. Is that so? Hakuin said, taking the child in his arms, waving goodbye to the parents. A year passed, and the real father returned to marry the young woman. At once they went to Hakuin to beg for the return of their child. We must have our daughter, they said. Is that so? Said Hakuin, handing the child to them. Joseph smiled and waited for my response. An interesting story, Joseph, but I don't understand why you're telling it to me now. I mean, your cafe just burned down. Is that so? He said. Then we laughed as I shook my head in resignation. Joseph, you're as crazy as Socrates. Why, thank you, Dan. And you're upset enough for both of us. Don't worry about me, though. I've been ready for a change. I'll probably move south soon, or north. It makes no difference. Well, don't go without saying goodbye. Goodbye, then, he said, giving me one of his hugs that left me glowing. I'll be leaving tomorrow. Are you going to say goodbye to Socrates? He laughed, replying, Socrates and I rarely say hello or goodbye. You'll understand later. With that, we parted. It was the last time I would see Joseph. About 3 a.m. Friday morning, I passed the clock at Shattuck and Center on my way to the gas station. I was more aware than ever of how much I still had to learn. I stepped into the office already talking.
Socrates, Joseph's cafe burned down tonight.
Strange, he said. Cafes usually burn up.
I couldn't believe it. He was making jokes.
Anyone hurt? He asked casually, without apparent concern.
Not that I know of. Did you hear me? Aren't you even a little bit upset?
Was Joseph upset when you spoke with him?
Well, no.
All right, then.
And that topic was simply closed.
Then, to my amazement, Socrates took out a pack of cigarettes and lit one.
Speaking of smoke, he said, did I ever mention to you that there's no such thing as a bad habit?
I couldn't believe my eyes or my ears. This isn't happening, I told myself.
No, you didn't, and I've gone to great lengths on your recommendation to change my bad habits.
Oh, that was to develop your will, you see, and to give your instincts a refresher course.
And we can say that habit itself, any unconscious compulsive ritual, is negative.
But specific activities, smoking, drinking, taking drugs, eating sweets, or asking silly questions, are bad and good. Every action has its price and its pleasures. Recognizing both sides, you become realistic and responsible for your actions. And only then can you make the warrior's free choice to do or not to do. There is a saying, when you sit, sit. When you stand, stand. Whatever you do, don't wobble. Once you make your choice, do it with all your spirit. Don't be like the evangelist who thought about praying while making love to his wife and thought about making love to his wife while praying. I laughed at this image while Socrates blew perfect smoke rings.